If you would, take your Bible and join me tonight in the Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 6 through 11. The return of the King. What a great day for a wedding. And we've come to that time in the song where their wedding takes place. It has all the overtones of an ancient Near Eastern wedding context as the procession of the husband makes his way to the home of the bride to bring her back to his home. And there's much here, believe it or not, for practical application that will give us insight into the wisdom that should approach a wedding and then the type of things that should transpire on a wedding day. Chapter 3, verse 6, what is that coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant? Behold, it is the litter of Solomon. Around it are 60 mighty men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords and expert in war, each with his sword at his thigh against terror by night. King Solomon made himself a carriage from the wood of Lebanon. He made its post of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple. The interior was inlaid with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go out, O daughters of Zion, and look upon King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. I have no doubt that the most important decision a person will ever make in all of life is whether or not they will repent of their sin and put their faith and trust in Jesus Christ. By God's good grace, I made that decision when I was a 10-year-old boy. And I will say tonight at the age of 57, without any hesitation, it was the greatest day of my life. He lived the life I should have lived and didn't. He died the death I should have died but don't have to. He offers a free gift that I do not deserve. Indeed, the great King of heaven, as Luke 19:10 says, came to seek and to save the lost, and he will save anyone who comes to him in repentance and in faith. But I'm also convinced that the second most important decision a person will ever make in all of their life is, who will I marry and who will I covenant to spend the rest of my life with? I think this is so important that any time I'm approached about performing a wedding, I inform the prospective couple that we will have to have at least three premarital counseling sessions. I now have, because of a bad experience some years ago, an ironclad rule. I will not consider marrying you unless the wedding is going to be 5 to 6 months out. In other words, if you say we're getting married in 3 weeks, wonderful. I might attend. I won't perform it. We were going to get married in a couple of months. Well, that's wonderful. I might attend, but I'm not going to perform it because I want to have sufficient time on my end to walk you through a number of things to, in my own conscience, be confident that you have a really good shot at making it, that you have a really good shot at going the distance. And so one of the things I require is that a couple sign a premarital wedding covenant. We'll meet the first time. At the end of that first meeting, I hand them the covenant, and I said, you need to read through this, take it home if you need to, and get back with me in a day or two. If you sign it, we'll move to the second step. If you don't sign it, that's fine. We're done. Because I'm not obligated to marry anybody. I had a man actually one time get angry with me and said, you should be sued if you don't perform weddings when people in your church come and ask you. And I just simply said, well, I'm not obligated to put anyone together in marriage that I don't think is ready for marriage, and sued or not, I'm not going to do it. But if I am confident that they are, then I'll be glad to. And so one of the things I require is this premarital wedding covenant. And I thought it might be a good exercise just to walk you through it so that if someday in the future you have kids or grandkids that for whatever reason wish for me to do their wedding, well, you'll let them know in advance, here's some of the things that that Mino Seminary president over there is going to require before he even moves into any further discussion. The premarital wedding covenant. The decision to marry is the second most important decision one will ever make in a lifetime. The first is the decision whether or not you will personally commit your life to Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. Keeping this in mind, we commit to God, our minister, and each other too. And you'll see that there are a number of things that follow, 10 exactly, and then a concluding paragraph. Number one, seek God's will for our lives personally and together by following biblical principles for Christian living and marriage. Two, not engage in premarital sex or any inappropriate sexual activity. Three, be sure to do everything possible to build a Christian marriage and home. This means that both of us have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Let me stop right there. I will not marry two unbelievers, nor will I marry a believer to an unbeliever under any circumstances. Now, I have friends that I love and respect that will marry two unbelievers. They'll marry two believers. They'll marry two unbelievers. But for me, and this is me, I see myself as a Christian minister. So that means I only perform Christian marriages. And for me, a Christian marriage is a covenantal relationship between a man who is a believer and a woman who is a believer. So for me, both have to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and they have to give evidence that they desire growth for that relationship over the entire course of their lives by being obedient to His Word. Number four, you must read and listen to all the premarital materials that I provide for you. And these are available at no cost at my website, and I designate the number of things they have to both listen to and they also have to read. Five, they must be active together in a Bible-believing church beginning now and during their marriage. If they're not active in a church right now, I won't marry them. And if they don't give me their word that they will be active in a church, I won't marry them. And they have to be in church together. I will not marry two people that one's going to go to one church over here and another's going to go to another church over there. I won't do it. Six, they must buy and read the following books: His Needs, Her Needs by Willard Harley. I recommend it highly. The Act of Marriage by Tim LaHaye, which is a very fine book. God on Sex that I have authored. And a little book called A Promise Kept by Robertson McQuilkin. Number seven, they must commit to total openness and honesty with our minister and with each other, both now and after the wedding. Eight, they must agree to postpone or cancel the marriage if at any time between now and the wedding, either one of us comes to believe this marriage is not right. And I don't care how much money it costs Daddy or anyone else. And I really don't. Number nine, never allow the word divorce to enter the realm of our relationship. We are in this together for the duration of our lives. Divorce is not an option for us. 10, seek competent Christian counsel should we encounter any difficulty in our marriage, beginning with the minister who performs our wedding. In other words, I get them to promise me, though I've had some lie, that if their marriage gets in trouble, they will call me and give me a chance to engage them in marital counseling to see if we can work through the difficulties that they have. Then, with the above commitments made, we believe God, and you may have a typo there, that God will be honored and the prospects for a meaningful and happy marriage enhanced. With God's help, we will seek to honor God with our lives and marriage all the days of our lives. I have the male, the prospective groom sign it. I have the woman, the prospective bride, sign it. I then make two copies of it. I give one to each of them, and I keep one for myself. And that's what I require after the very first meeting, which also goes about an hour before I will move on and talk to them about the possibility of me doing their wedding. I take it that seriously, and I believe the decision is that important. Just as a, this is for free. Charlotte and I had no premarital counseling. None. I lived in Dallas. She lived in Atlanta. I go home to marry her. On the Sunday before we marry the next Saturday, our pastor announced that after 20 years of marriage, he and his wife were separating and getting a divorce. Monday morning, we met with him, and he said, you know, I normally have some things I say, but after last night, I don't feel like I can, so I will see you all at the rehearsal dinner Friday evening. And that was the totality of our premarital counseling. So you say, well, how'd y'all get off? Rocky. Rough. In fact, I've been talking to a number of different couples over the last several weeks, and they've all been very honest with me, saying this: you know, we deeply love each other. We are absolutely committed and believe we'll be married for the rest of our lives. But our first year, it was tough. Some said, our first 2 years, they were tough. And if you were to ask us, were our first couple of years rough? Yeah, they really were. We loved each other. We were in it to the bloody end, and I thought there was going to be some blood because we, just two strong-willed people, hard-headed, hers harder than mine, and as a result of that, there was just some head knocking that went on and some negotiating that had to take place. We're still working on it 35 years later, but we worked at it at a real intense level in those first couple of years. And so my goal in premarital counseling is to try to get you in the very best possible situation to get off to a good start, because we all are going to have struggles in marriage, no matter how much we love each other and no matter how much we are committed to the relationship. So what do we find in our text? Shulamite has suffered a bad dream, a nightmare. We saw that last week in 3:1-5. Perhaps Solomon had returned to the city. That's the dream that she has in verses 2 and 3. She's alone in the countryside where they had gone in chapter 2, verses 8 through 17. In her dream, she goes in search of the one she says is the one I love, making that statement four times. Finally, in verse 4, she finds him. They're united. She makes it crystal clear she is not going to let this man go. Well, finally, her dream is going to give way to reality as she is reunited with her shepherd king. And now she's not the one who's going after him. He is the one in verses 6 to 11 who is coming after her with his royal wedding entourage on the day of their wedding. So the days of courting have come to an end. The time for their marriage is at hand. The celebration of their wedding night we will see next week in chapter 4, verse 1 through chapter 5, verse 1, which, by the way, is both the center and the heart of the book. And so everything moves to our lesson next week, and everything then moves away from it after that. And so finally, that statement we see three times in the book in 2:7, in 3:5, and 8:4. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases, until it is the right time. Well, the right time finally has arrived. Now, it's very interesting to note how the wedding ceremony and the wedding preparation took place in the ancient world. And Thomas Constable, a professor at Dallas Seminary, helps it out here when he says, and I quote, "Weddings in Israel took place in front of the local town elders, not the priest." See Ruth 4:10-11. They transpired in homes, not in the tabernacle or temple or synagogue in later times. They were rather civil rather than religious ceremonies. Now, there were three parts to a wedding in the ancient Near East. First, the groom's parents selected a bride for their son. This involved securing the permission of the bride's parents and the approval of both the bride and the groom themselves. And though the parents of the young couple arranged the marriage, they usually obtained the consent of both the bride and the groom, which, by the way, is probably not a bad pattern, though I seriously doubt it's going to be adopted any time in our Western culture and certainly in the U.S. Second, on the wedding day, the groom proceeded to the bride's house accompanied by a group of friends. He then escorted her to the site of the wedding ceremony and finally took her to their new residence accompanied by their friends. Physical union consummated the marriage the night after the wedding ceremony took place. And then third, the couple feasted with their friends, usually if they had the financial means, for up to 7 days. So they partied hardy for quite a while following the wedding ceremony. And so that's how it took place in the ancient Near East. And so what we see taking place here is that first part where the groom with his entourage comes to the home of his bride to pick her up and take her to the place of the wedding ceremony. So from these six verses, there are four things I want us to see this evening that I think give us insight into the kind of characteristics that should indeed accompany every wedding ceremony that our God has planned for those who long to honor Him in the sacred covenantal union of Christian marriage. And indeed, it is both a beautiful and fantastic scene. So, number one, a great wedding will involve a public celebration. A great wedding will involve a public celebration. Verse 6 and verse 7. Who is this, or what is this, that is coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with the fragrant powders of a merchant? Behold, it is the litter of Solomon. Around it are 60 mighty men, some of the mighty men of Israel. The scene shifts, doesn't it, from the privacy of her bedroom to now the public venue. It's the day of her wedding to her shepherd king. And so the author, probably Solomon, takes the posture of a narrator as he describes for us this unfolding scene of his coming for his bride in all this majesty and all this pomp and circumstance. Indeed, Jack Deere says it like this: the pomp and beauty of this procession were wholly appropriate in light of the event's significance. The scriptures teach that marriage is one of the most important events in a person's life. Therefore, it is fitting that the union of a couple be commemorated in a special way. The current practice of couples casually living together apart from the bonds of marriage demonstrates how unfashionable genuine commitment to another person has become in contemporary society. Unfortunately, this violates the sanctity of marriage, and it is contrary to God's standards of purity. And so this marriage has all the trappings, I think, that God would say, my pleasure rests upon it. The text says that the king is coming up from, don't miss this now, the wilderness. That's important. The theme of the wilderness, as we've already seen, is an important one. It's a very rich one in the Old Testament, and it invokes. It would have, to a Jew reading this in their day, to a Hebrew, they would have thought of the Exodus, the wandering in the Exodus, the hardships and the difficulties that one would equate with being out there in the wilderness. Furthermore, the wilderness reminds us that the ravaging effects of the curse and sin are ever present in this fallen world, and that the most precious and tender relationships, like marriage, are not immune to its influences. Interestingly, Elijah, 1 Kings 19, John the Baptist, Matthew 3, the Lord Jesus, Matthew 4, all had trying, difficult wilderness experiences. But the Lord was faithful to each of them, as he was faithful to Israel, to sustain them and provide for them. And he can do exactly the same thing in our marriages, even though we live in the context of a broken, fallen, beat-up world. Shulamite, if you go back and look at chapters 1 and 2, has indeed lived through a number of difficult and trying experiences. It would not be stretching the text at all to say she has lived through a number of wilderness-type experiences. But now, those days are going to come to an end as her shepherd king comes to take her to be his bride. And so he comes in full display. He wants everyone to see that he is coming to fetch his wife, this woman that he loves. And here's what's interesting. What appears to be, quote, columns of smoke are actually the sweet scents of both myrrh and frankincense. Very exotic spices imported from places like Arabia and India. So very costly, very precious. He is sparing no expense as the king as he comes for his bride. Now again, understand, a man can only do what a man can do. All right? A man can only do what a man can do. And I'll just say this. This is also for free. You are stupid to go into massive debt for a wedding. Terminal stupidity, total and complete ignorance. And guys, I don't mean to be unkind, but if you have a woman that's demanding that, she may not be the right girl, because that would not be what's most important to her. Now, I'm not opposed to having nice weddings. I am opposed to having exorbitant, over-the-top, out-of-sight weddings where people wind up spending $30,000 and $50,000 and $80,000 and $100,000 and going in debt to do so. That's a great way to get off to a disastrous start in life when you've got to be paying those kind of things off. But today, we live in an age where people feel like they've got to outdo the other person, and they've got to come up with something that's never been done before. And so be wise, but at the same time, don't hesitate to put on a biblically faithful, godly display of love for this person that you care for. So from Shulamite's perspective, as well as the audience watching the scene, things look good and things smell good. And he's making, again, I underline this, a public display of his love and affection for his bride. And he invites all who are there to join in this celebration. He's not calling her to sneak away. He's not trying to elope. He indeed is happy for the world to know, this is my lady, and this is the woman that I want to spend the rest of my life with. It is interesting, by the way, to note that in Matthew chapter 2 and verse 11, when the Magi saw the baby Jesus, they fell to their knees and they worshiped him. And what did they do? But they gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Why? Because these are gifts fitting for a king. Solomon says, these are gifts fitting for my queen. And it's in a sense a token whereby he says to her, I'm going to look at you as a queen, and I'm going to treat you as a queen too. And indeed, we will see privately in chapter 4, 1 through 16, and later publicly that he will honor her, he will cherish her as God did Israel, and as Christ does his church in Ephesians 5, 25 through 33. In fact, very interestingly, and this is one of the reasons I think the Song of Songs is an ideal portrait, it's an ideal picture of what marriage should be, that it's not literally talking about a marriage that Solomon had to a particular wife. Do you know that in the 8 chapters of the Song of Songs, not one time is anything ever negative said about Solomon? Not one time. He is the ideal king. He is the ideal shepherd. He is the ideal husband. He is a picture of the coming king and shepherd and bridegroom whose name is Jesus. He does not stack up in real life to the male figure portrayed so beautifully in this particular book. However, again, looking at it in its greater Old Testament context, Israel would forget the Lord, quote, from Jeremiah 2:7, who brought us from the land of Egypt, who led us through the wilderness, through a land of deserts and ravines, through a land of drought and darkness, a land no one traveled through and where no one lived. No, this shepherd king publicly pledges that his bride will never again find herself in the wilderness. He's going to take her to be his wife. And indeed, we have a future shepherd king who will do it even more. His public pledge, not coming on a chariot with frankincense and myrrh. No, his public pledge is a Roman cross and an empty Judean tomb. Yes, a great wedding will involve a public celebration. Secondly, a great wedding contains a promise of protection as well. Verse 7, behold, it is the litter of Solomon. Around it are 60 mighty men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords and expert in war, each with his sword at his thigh against the by the night. The scene unfolds, and more clarity is now being added in verse 7 and verse 8. Yes, the vision of the columns of smoke that are burning are myrrh and frankincense from every fragrant powder of the merchant. Indeed, no expense was spared. That's now shown to be the case. And now we see that this vision that she saw is actually nothing less than Solomon's royal litter or his carriage. And it, what is it? Is it coming alone? No. It is surrounded not by 30 like with David, but by 60 warriors from the mighty men of Israel. In other words, to put it in our contemporary vernacular, he's coming with his elite soldiers. He's coming with his Navy SEALs. He's coming, if you like, with his Army Rangers. These are his hand-picked personal bodyguards, armed, ready for action at any particular moment. How do we know? Well, look. First, they are, it says, warriors from the mighty of Israel. Verse 7. Second, all of them are skilled with swords and trained in warfare. Third, each has his sword at his side to guard against the terror of the night. And so Shulamite, who felt alone and unprotected in chapter 3, verse 1, is now promised that that will never, ever, ever happen again. She is under the watch care of her shepherd king, and she has at her beck and call his mighty resources that indeed will protect her and care for her. These are then his pledge again, a promise of protection and a promise that he will always be there for her, that until death do they part, she does not have to worry about being provided for and cared for. Of course, in the context, these mighty men are going to serve as groomsmen, as we would talk of it, and these are his closest friends. These are the people that he believes could guard his back in the foxhole. These are the people that he's convinced would take a bullet for him. In fact, not only would they take a bullet for him, they'd kill somebody for him. These are the kind of men he could trust his life or wife to. And I often use that phrase, by the way, when I talk about a real friend. I mean, someone that I actually have absolute, complete, and total confidence in. I say, you know, he's the kind of guy I could trust my life or my wife with. I could trust him in the foxhole to take a bullet for me and, if necessary, kill for me. There are, by the way, not that many friends in real life. And the ones you have, you should cherish them as a wonderful, precious gift. Mark Driscoll, in a sermon on this text, got very practical as he applied this to the Mars Hill congregation. And so he said this about what these verses imply in terms of application. Quote, he's looking out for her safety and her well-being. And this is something that a man has the great opportunity to do with the woman that he loves. In our day, this would include things like this, a safe car. Living in a place that is safe and well-lit and not dangerous and crime-infested. This would include she gets a cell phone so that if an emergency comes, she can contact him. You're always accessible and available. This would also include things like medical insurance, life insurance, so that even if in the occasion of your death, she's still provided for and or your children. Thus, he's a man who thinks through issues of safety and protection, provision. So here we see him coming to pick her up. 60 warriors carrying her into town. An enormous wedding day. The kind of wedding day that little girls dress up like princesses for and practice. Beginning at a very young age for this kind of amazing wedding day. I think he's got some real insight there. And my friend Tommy Nelson, who pastors the Denton Bible Church in Denton, Texas, says it like this, and it's a great quote. Part of the safety and security of the wedding ceremony will be evident in the people who serve as your best man, maid or matron of honor, groomsman, and bridesmaid. Choose godly people who will support you fully in the vows you make. As a whole, those who witness your marriage should be like a holy hedge of protection around you, keeping you focused toward each other inside that circle of matrimony and keeping out anybody who might try to destroy your marriage. Don't ask someone to stand up for you who isn't completely committed to you, to your marriage, and in general to the sanctity and value of marriage. Such a person will not encourage you to work through problems in your marriage. Such a person will not do the utmost to help you and your spouse when you need help. And they may embarrass you at the rehearsal dinner. So people that are like that, kick them to the curb. Let them be invited, but don't give them a position of prominence wherein they stand as witnesses and promises and pledges of protection, support, prayer, and so on. Number three, a great wedding does indeed include a pledge of love. Verse 9, King Solomon made himself a carriage. Some have the word a sedan chair. Some use the word palanquin from the wood of Lebanon. Oh, it is made, its post of silver. Its back, oh, it's made of gold. Its seat, the finest purple. Its interior, whatever this means, was inlaid with love put there by the daughters of Jerusalem. When it comes to contemporary popular arrangements of cohabitation, It's not surprising that over half never result in any kind of formal marriage taking place. And the reason is, when it comes to cohabitation, there are really two missing C words, almost without exception. One is the word Christ, which is not in your notes, by the way, but the other is the word commitment. And where there is no commitment, one should not be surprised that the arrangement does not last and it doesn't go the distance. In my preparation for this particular study, I came across a number of articles that surprised me. Well, they didn't surprise me. They just grieved me and broke my heart, because I found out that more and more modern wedding ceremonies are dropping the phrases like, till death do us part. And they're using more cautious and tentative promises like, quote, for as long as our marriage shall serve the common good. Whatever the heck that means. Or bride vows, I do until I don't. Or, I promise to be loyal as long as our love lasts. And, I promise to be faithful until our time together is over. By the way, this is also for free. I write the wedding vows that are done in my weddings. I'll let you make suggestions. I have absolute, total, complete veto power over anything and everything. The songs that are sung, the words that are spoken, the dress that you are going to wear, both male and, well, guy ain't gonna wear a dress, but whatever he dresses like and whatever she dresses like, I get to see it. And if I don't approve it, I ain't doing it. If that's none of your business, it's all my business. If you want me to sign off on your wedding contract, it certainly is my business. Too many ministers take this thing way too lightly. Now you say, well, you're too serious. I'd rather be too serious on this issue than too wimpish, a sissy, someone that didn't have enough guts to look a young couple or an older couple, for that matter, in the face and say, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. It's my wedding. Well, it may be your wedding, but I'm presiding, and we're not doing that. So it can be, I preside, and we'll do it this way, or you can do it your way, and I won't preside. Your call on that point. But if we're going to do it with me being involved, it's going to be done my way, because I'm not going to do one thing that I think would dishonor the sacred gift of marriage given to us by our great God. I'm not going to do it. And again, without being ugly, we're most of us in here are older. Young people are dumb. I mean, you do understand that, don't you? When you were young, when I was young, you say, well, I was brilliant when I was young. Well, you're a liar, too. No, you weren't. Young people have not lived a long time. Young people lack experience. Those of us who are ministers, how many weddings have we done in our lives? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And hopefully you're going to do it one time. So the odds are, just because of what we do for a living, we've got a little bit more experience in this area than a 19 or 20 or 21, or for that matter, a 30 or 31-year-old. And so we want to make sure that things are done that honor the sanctity and the sacredness and the gift of marriage. So what do we see? Marriage is designed by God, involves a lifelong commitment to covenantal love. There is a pledge, as we're seeing in this text, and a promise in this text, a physical, spiritual, emotional, and personal commitment. One more time. Physical, spiritual, emotional, personal commitment that only God brings to an end. And we see this now fleshed out in verse 9 and verse 10. Look at it. The wedding carriage, the Holman Christian Standard calls it a sedan chair. Its marginal reading is that word I used a moment ago, a palanquin. Well, it tells us that King Solomon made this for himself. And how did he make it? Oh, my goodness, he made it of the very best materials money could buy. The wood was from Lebanon. The timbers of those forests were in great demand and highly expensive. It was from that wood that Solomon had carved his sedan chair or his carriage. To that, he added posts that were of silver. He added supports that were of gold. He had a seat that was covered by the finest purple. So all of this was exquisitely beautiful. It was quite expensive, but again, he was the king. But what the king is saying to his bride is, by this chair that he has made for their wedding day, I'll keep nothing back from you. All I have belongs to you, and I love this idea. You will always receive my best. But then we come to verse 10, and Bible scholars went all over the place with this one. They don't know what to do with it, and I don't either, but I'm going to give it my best shot. Verse 10 informs us that the carriage's interior is inlaid with love by the young women of Jerusalem. Now, what in the world is meant by that phrase, inlaid with love? I mean, let's be honest, it's vague, it's mysterious. It is the young women of Jerusalem who do it, who, providing kind of the counterpart to the mighty warriors. But what are we to make of what they are saying here? And as I said, folks go in all sorts of different directions, but of all the people I read, and I read about 15 different guys, I think Charles Spurgeon said it best, and I quote, "It is a complicated but very expressive form of speech. Some regard the expression as signifying a pavement of stone engraved with hieroglyphic emblems of love, which made up the floor of the traveling carriage, chariot. But this would surely be very uncomfortable. It'd also be very heavy, I might add, and really quite unusual. Others, therefore, have explained the passage as referring to choice embroidery and dainty carpets woven with cost and care, with which the interior of the traveling chair was lined. Into such embroidery, sentences of love poetry may have been worked." And I kind of like that better, and I think it fits better what I would expect of a Hebrew who is a follower of Yahweh. Needlework was probably the material of which it was composed. Skillful fingers would therefore set forth emblems and symbols of love. As the spouse in the second chapter sings, "His banner over me was love," probably alluding to some love word upon the banner. So probably tokens of love were carved or embroidered, as the case may have been, upon the interior of the chariot, so that the midst thereof was paved with love for the daughters of Jerusalem. But then Spurgeon says, "We need not, however, tarry long over the metaphor, but endeavor to profit by its teaching." In other words, but that's my best shot. Don't spend too much time there. We need to move on. But I do think we're on safe ground in affirming that the phrase speaks clearly to the truth that love will be their promise and pledge to each other from their wedding day until their death day. And John Phillips, who went to be with the Lord just a couple of years ago, says the phrase simply suggests all that is romantic. And I would add, it also suggests all that one person commits to another in covenantal marriage. Love, not lust, will be their circle of protection. Love, not infatuation, will be their companion for life. And again, this is the right place for a Christ-honoring marriage to see such things take place. By the way, we will see a super expression of what love looks like in this book when we get to our very last study in chapter 8, verses 5 through 14, a passage that within the marital context complements beautifully Paul's love chapter in 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 8. Number 4. A wedding day, a great wedding day, has the approval of others. Look at verse 11. "Go out, O daughters of Zion," which I think is another way of saying the daughters of Jerusalem. "Look upon King Solomon. Look upon King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart." The wedding of this great shepherd king is the occasion for great celebration and rejoicing. By the way, there is also a wedding song of a king in Psalm 45. You ought to look at it when you have the opportunity. The daughters of Jerusalem, the young women of Jerusalem, now called the young women of Zion, are commanded to come out and to gaze, to look intently upon Solomon wearing the crown his mother, in this context, Bathsheba, placed on his head on the day of his wedding. It's called the day of his heart's rejoicing. Now, one cannot help but draw a contrast between this wedding day for Solomon and the wedding day of his mother, Bathsheba. She'd been seduced into an adulterous affair by King David. She became pregnant, according to chapter 11 of 2 Samuel. David then murdered her husband Uriah to cover up his sin, also 2 Samuel 11. She would mourn his death and then be taken by David in marriage, also in 2 Samuel 11. The scriptures record no fanfare or celebration, none. And we all know it's one of the most sordid stories, one of the saddest stories in all the Bible. But now this wedding is different. She can applaud this union, and so can everyone else. The marriage is right. The couple is right for each other. The young women of Zion join in the celebration of the wedding. In other words, their friends say, "We approve of this marriage." In other words, and this is so important, listen to it. In their mind, this is a good and wonderful thing that is about to happen. They like Solomon when he is with Shulamite, because she brings out the best in him, not the worst, when they're together. The same is true for Shulamite. She is a better and more beautiful woman when she is with her shepherd king. This is a good sign for all of us to always be on the lookout for. In other words, if all of your family and all of your friends are against this, you might want to slow down and think it through. Because the odds are, if everyone is against it, but you, they probably have good reasons. They're at least thinking through it. Now, I know they're the exceptions. I know they're the exceptions. But more often than not, if the parents are against it, and if your friends say, "You know what, when you're around her, you just become hyper-jealous. And when you've been with her, we can tell because you're just a grouch, and you just have a sour disposition after spending time with her." I dated a girl in high school, and it would have been an unmitigated disaster had we stayed together. And I can remember one day, one of my teachers, I think she liked me. We went at it a lot because I was a smart mouth when I was in high school. But she said, "Come here a minute." And I came over. She said, "You know, you really need to quit dating that girl." And I said, "Well, why do you say that?" She said, "Because you just get moody and you get grouchy and you have a frown on your face. And she's just no good for you. You two are not good together." And by the way, my mother, who's probably the sweetest person on the planet, hated her guts. Well, my mother didn't hate anybody, but I'm using a figure of speech at this point. That's my way of saying my mother was not fond of her, and she let me know it. Charlotte, oh my Lord, she fell in love with her the first time I met her. And in fact, I broke up with her one time, and she would not talk to me for 2 weeks. Can you believe your mother would give you the cold shoulder for 2 weeks? And I said, "What's your problem?" And she said, "I have a son that's an idiot." And my mother would never use the word idiot. I used the word idiot. She never used the word idiot. She said, "You're an idiot." And I said, "Well, what's that all about?" She said, "If you don't have enough sense to see that this is the right girl for you, I can't help you." And she walked out of the room. And I'm like, "Dude, what is this all about?" Well, what it was all about was my mother had great wisdom and insight into who would be exactly the right person for her son. Now, again, I know there are exceptions to the rule. Actually, those exceptions make the rule. And so what we simply see here is the approval of Solomon's family, the approval of Shulamite's friends, and so there's no problems with in-laws looming as best we can tell. She is excited about the wedding day. She's provided and prepared this crown that symbolizes the gladness and the joy of the wedding day. And indeed, it's interesting, according to rabbinic tradition, crowns were worn by the bridegroom and the bride from the time of Solomon coming forward until the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And so those who loved Solomon and Shulamite were most confident that this marriage was meant to be and meant to last. Their approval is no guarantee, but it is an indication of the confidence both family and friends had in the rightness of their union, something that we all should seek when it comes to the approval and support of our family and our friends. Now, for time's sake, I'm going to just simply note that in your notes, I have given you a practical application section that contrasts in 10 ways what lust is like and what love is like. Very, very, very insightful. And I would encourage you to walk through it. Dennis Ringstad wrote this, and it's a very insightful comparison of what lust is and what love really is. Go to the end of that, and let me just note very quickly, and then we're going to close this evening by watching a video that'll take 4 minutes, but you'll be moved, I promise you. I came across it in my preparation. Go to the back of your notes where it says, "How does this text then point us to Christ?" And the theme of it is, looking forward to the return of the king. And here we go. Song of Song 3, 6 through 11 is about a shepherd king coming for his beautiful virgin bride. He comes with his armies and he is wearing a crown fit for the occasion. It is a magnificent scene to be sure, but it pales in comparison to the wedding processional it anticipates. A wedding processional described in Revelation chapter 19 when King Jesus, the shepherd king greater than David or Solomon, returns from heaven to get his bride, his wife. Chapter 19, verse 7. He will not come up from the wilderness with the memories of the fall and the deliverance of the Exodus occupying our minds. No. He will descend from heaven riding a white horse. On his head will not be a simple crown, but many diadems, because he is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And, note, the armies of heaven will accompany this bridegroom, and he will shepherd the nations with an iron scepter. Song of Songs then stirs our hearts for another wedding day that will consummate all of human history. There we will celebrate the marriage of the Lamb that was slain for his bride, whom he purchased with his own blood, Revelation 5, 9 and 10. On that day, as Jonathan Edwards so eloquently wrote, and you have this in your notes, the church shall be brought to the full enjoyment of her bridegroom, having all tears wiped away from her eyes, and there shall be no distance or absence. She shall then be brought to the entertainments of an eternal wedding feast and to dwell forever with her bridegroom, yea, to dwell eternally in his embraces. Then Christ will give her his loves, and she shall drink her fill. Yea, I love this. She shall swim in the ocean of his love. And so as we close tonight, there is a wonderful song by the group Casting Crowns entitled Wedding Day. It's been viewed by almost 500,000 people. And as I was working through this text, I just thought, you know, this is a beautiful way to close our study of the wedding that we find in the Song of Songs. But also, it anticipates the wedding that we look forward to when our great king comes for his bride in Revelation chapter 19. So guys, if y'all would, and when it's over, we will be dismissed.